put her ear to the metal again. This time, she definitely heard voices. Getting louder. And footsteps. The latch engaged from inside. Gabrielle had no time to hide as the metal door burst open. She jumped to the side, plastering herself against the wall behind the door, as a group of people hurried through, talking loudly. They sounded angry. "What the hell is Harper's problem? I thought he'd be on cloud nine." "On a night like tonight," another said as the group passed by. "He wants to be alone? He should be celebrating." As the group moved away from Gabrielle, the heavy door started swinging closed on pneumatic hinges, revealing her location. She remained rigid as the men continued down the hall. Waiting as long as she possibly could until the door was only inches from closing, Gabrielle lunged forward and caught the door handle with just inches to spare. She stood motionless as the men turned the corner down the hall, too engaged in their conversation to look back. Heart pounding, Gabrielle pulled open the door and stepped into the dimly lit area beyond. She quietly closed the door. The space was a wide-open work area that reminded her of a college physics laboratory. Computers, work islands, electronic gear. As her eyes became accustomed to the darkness, Gabrielle could see blueprints and sheets of calculations scattered around. The entire area was dark, except for an office on the far side of the lab, where a light shone under the door. Gabrielle walked over quietly. The door was closed, but through the window she could see a man sitting at a computer. She recognized the man from the NASA press conference. The nameplate on the door read, "Chris Harper, Section Manager, Pods." Having come this far, Gabrielle suddenly felt apprehensive, wondering if she could actually pull this off. She reminded herself how certain Sexton was that Chris Harper had lied. "I would bet my campaign on it," Sexton had said. Apparently there were others who felt the same, others who were waiting for Gabrielle to uncover the truth so they could close in on NASA, attempting to gain even a tiny foothold after tonight's devastating developments. After the way Tench and the Herney administration had played Gabrielle this afternoon, she was eager to help. Gabrielle raised her hand to knock on the door, but paused, Yolanda's voice running through her mind. "If Chris Harper lied to the world about Pods, what makes you think he'll tell you the truth?" Fear, Gabrielle told herself, having almost fallen victim to it herself today. She had a plan. It involved a tactic she'd seen the senator use on occasion to scare information out of political opponents. Gabrielle had absorbed a lot under Sexton's tutelage, and not all of it attractive or ethical. But tonight she needed every advantage. If she could persuade Chris Harper to admit he had lied, for whatever reason, Gabrielle would open a small door of opportunity for the senator's campaign. Beyond that, Sexton was a man who, if given an inch to maneuver, could wriggle his way out of almost any jam. Gabrielle's plan for dealing with Harper was something Sexton called overshooting, an interrogation technique invented by the early Roman authorities to coax confessions from criminals they suspected were lying. The method was deceptively simple. Assert the information you want confessed, then allege something far worse. The object was to give the opponent a chance to choose the lesser of two evils, in this case, the truth. The trick was exuding confidence, something Gabrielle wasn't feeling at the moment. Taking a deep breath, Gabrielle ran through the script in her mind and then knocked firmly on the office door.
"I tell you I'm busy,"
Harper called out, his English accent familiar. She knocked again, louder.
"I tell you I'm not interested in coming down."
This time she banged on the door with her fist. Chris Harper came over and yanked open the door.
"Bloody hell, do you—"
He stopped short, clearly surprised to see Gabrielle.
"Dr. Harper," she said, infusing her voice with intensity.
"How did you get up here?"
Gabrielle's face was stern.
"Do you know who I am?"
"Of course. Your boss has been slamming my project for months."
"How did you get in?"
"Senator Sexton sent me." Harper's eyes scanned the lab behind Gabriel.
Where is your staff escort?
That's not your concern. The senator has influential connections.
In this building?
Harper looked dubious.
You've been dishonest, Dr. Harper. And I'm afraid the senator has called a special senatorial justice board to look into your lies.
A pall crossed Harper's face.
What are you talking about?
Smart people like yourself don't have the luxury of playing stupid, Dr. Harper. You're in trouble. And the senator sent me up here to offer you a deal. The senator's campaign took a huge hit tonight. He's got nothing left to lose, and he's ready to take you down with him if he needs to.
What the devil are you talking about?
Gabriel took a deep breath and made her play. You lied in your press conference about the pod's anomaly detection software.
We know that. A lot of people know that. That's not the issue.
Before Harper could open his mouth to argue, Gabriel steamed onward.
The senator could blow the whistle on your lies right now, but he's not interested. He's interested in the bigger story.
I think you know what I'm talking about.
No, Here's the senator's offer. He'll keep his mouth shut about your software lies if you give him the name of the top NASA executive with whom you're embezzling funds.
Chris Harper's eyes seemed to cross for a moment.
What? I'm not embezzling.
I suggest you watch what you say, sir. The senatorial committee has been collecting documentation for months now.
Did you really think you two would slip by undetected? Doctoring Pod's paperwork and redirecting allocated NASA funds to private accounts? Lying and embezzling can put you in jail, Dr. Harper. I did no such things.
You're saying you didn't lie about Pod's?
No, I'm saying I bloody well didn't embezzle money.
So you're saying you did lie about Pod's? Harper stared, clearly at a loss for words.
Forget about the lying, Gabriel said, waving it off. Senator Sexton isn't interested in the issue of your lying in a press conference. We're used to that. You guys found a meteorite. Nobody cares how you did it. The issue for him is the embezzlement. He needs to take down someone high in NASA. Just tell him who you're working with, and he'll steer the investigation clear of you entirely. You can make it easy and tell us who the other person is, or the senator will make it ugly and start talking about anomaly detection software and phony workarounds. You're bluffing. There are no embezzled funds.
You're an awful liar, Dr. Harper. I've seen the documentation. Your name is on all the incriminating paperwork, over and over.
I swear I know nothing about any embezzlement.
Gabriel let out a disappointed sigh.
Put yourself in my position, Dr. Harper.
I can only draw two conclusions here. Either you're lying to me, the same way you lied in that press conference, or you're telling the truth, and someone powerful in the agency is setting you up as a fall guy for his own misdealings. The proposition seemed to give Harper pause. Gabrielle checked her watch. The senator's deal is on the table for an hour. You can save yourself by giving him the name of the NASA exec with whom you're embezzling taxpayers' money. He doesn't care about you. He wants the big fish. Obviously, the individual in question has some power here at NASA. He or she has managed to keep his or her identity off the paper trail, allowing you to be the fall guy. Harper shook his head.
You're lying.
Would you like to tell that to a court?
Sure. I'll deny the whole thing.
Under oath? Gabriel grunted in disgust.
Suppose you'll also deny you lied about fixing the pod software.
Gabrielle's heart was pounding as she stared straight into the man's eyes.
Think carefully about your options here, Dr. Harper. American prisons can be most unpleasant.
Harper glared back, and Gabrielle willed him to fold. For a moment she thought she saw a glimmer of surrender, but when Harper spoke, his voice was like steel.
Miss Ash, he declared, anger simmering in his eyes. You are clutching at thin air. You and I both know there was no embezzlement going on at NASA. The only liar in this room is you.
Gabrielle felt her muscles go rigid. The man's gaze was angry and sharp. She wanted to turn and run.
You tried to bluff a rocket scientist. What the hell did you expect?
She forced herself to hold her head high.
All I know,
she said, feigning utter confidence and indifference to his position, is the incriminating documents I've seen. Conclusive evidence that you and another are embezzling NASA funds. The senator simply asked me to come here tonight and offer you the option of giving up your partner instead of facing the inquiry alone. I will tell the senator you prefer to take your chances with a judge. You can tell the court what you told me. You're not embezzling funds, and you didn't lie about the pod software. She gave a grim smile. But after that lame press conference you gave 2 weeks ago, somehow I doubt it.
Gabrielle spun on her heel and strode across the darkened pod's laboratory. She wondered if maybe she'd be seeing the inside of a prison instead of Harper.
Gabrielle held her head high as she walked off, waiting for Harper to call her back. Silence. She pushed her way through the metal doors and strode out into the hallway, hoping the elevators up here were not keycard operated like the lobby. She'd lost. Despite her best efforts, Harper wasn't biting. Maybe he was telling the truth in his pod's press conference, Gabrielle thought. A crash resounded down the hall as the metal doors behind her burst open.
Miss Ash! Harper's voice called out. I swear I know nothing about any embezzlement. I'm an honest man.
Gabrielle felt her heart skip a beat. She forced herself to keep walking. She gave a casual shrug and called out over her shoulder.
And yet you lied in your press conference.
Silence. Gabrielle kept moving down the hallway.
Hold on!
Harper yelled. He came jogging up beside her, his face pale.
This embezzlement thing, he said, lowering his voice. I think I know who set me up.
Gabrielle stopped dead in her tracks, wondering if she had heard him correctly. She turned as slowly and casually as she could.
You expect me to believe someone is setting you up?
Harper sighed.
I swear I know nothing about embezzlement. But if there's evidence against me...
Mounds of it. Harper sighed.
Then it's all been planted. To discredit me, if need be. And there's only one person who would have done that.
Who? Harper looked her in the eye.
Lawrence Ekstrom hates me.
Gabrielle was stunned.
The administrator of NASA?
Harper gave a grim nod.
He's the one who forced me to lie in that press conference.
Chapter 88. Even with the Aurora aircraft's misted methane propulsion system at half power, the Delta Force was hurtling through the night at 3 times the speed of sound, over 2,000 miles an hour. The repetitive throb of the pulse detonation wave engines behind them gave the ride a hypnotic rhythm. 100 feet below, the ocean churned wildly, whipped up by the Aurora's vacuum wake, which sucked 50-foot rooster tails skyward in long, parallel sheets behind the plane. This is the reason the SR-71 Blackbird was retired, Delta One thought. The Aurora was one of those secret aircraft that nobody was supposed to know existed, but everyone did. Even the Discovery Channel had covered Aurora and its testing out at Groom Lake in Nevada. Whether the security leaks had come from the repeated skyquakes heard as far away as Los Angeles, or the unfortunate eyewitness sighting by a North Sea oil rig driller, or the administrative gaffe that left a description of Aurora in a public copy of the Pentagon budget, nobody would ever know. It hardly mattered. The word was out. The U.S. military had a plane capable of Mach 6 flight, and it was no longer on the drawing board. It was in the skies overhead. Built by Lockheed, the Aurora looked like a flattened American football. It was 110 feet long, 60 feet wide, smoothly contoured with a crystalline patina of thermal tiles, much like the space shuttle. The speed was primarily the result of an exotic new propulsion system known as Pulse Detonation Wave Engine, which burned a clean, misted liquid hydrogen and left a telltale pulse contrail in the sky. For this reason, it only flew at night. Tonight, with the luxury of enormous speed, the Delta Force was taking the long way home, out across the open ocean. Even so, they were overtaking their quarry. At this rate, the Delta Force would be arriving on the eastern seaboard in under an hour, a good 2 hours before its prey. There had been a discussion of tracking and shooting down the plane in question, but the controller rightly feared a radar capture of the incident or the burned wreckage might bring on a massive investigation. It was best to let the plane land as scheduled, the controller had decided. Once it became clear where their quarry intended to land, the Delta Force would move in. Now, as Aurora streaked over the desolate Labrador Sea, Delta One's cryptalk indicated an incoming call. He answered. "The situation has changed," the electronic voice informed them. "You have another mark before Rachel Sexton and the scientists land." Another mark. Delta One could feel it. Things were unraveling. The controller's ship had sprung another leak, and the controller needed them to patch it as fast as possible. The ship would not be leaking, Delta One reminded himself, if we had hit our marks successfully on the Milne ice shelf. Delta One knew damn well he was cleaning up his own mess. "A fourth party has become involved," the controller said.
"Who?"
The controller paused a moment and then gave them a name. The three men exchanged startled looks. It was a name they knew well. No wonder the controller sounded reluctant, Delta One thought. For an operation conceived as a zero-casualty venture, the body count and target profile was climbing fast. He felt his sinews tighten as the controller prepared to inform them exactly how and where they would eliminate this new individual. "The stakes have increased considerably," the controller said. "Listen closely. I will give you these instructions only once." Chapter 89. High above northern Maine, a G-4 jet continued speeding toward Washington. On board, Michael Tolland and Corky Marlinson looked on as Rachel Sexton began to explain her theory for why there might be increased hydrogen ions in the fusion crust of the meteorite. "NASA has a private test facility called Plum Brook Station," Rachel explained, hardly able to believe she was going to talk about this. Sharing classified information out of protocol was not something she had ever done, but considering the circumstances, Tolland and Corky had a right to know this. "Plum Brook is essentially a test chamber for NASA's most radical new engine systems. 2 years ago, I wrote a gist about a new design NASA was testing there, something called an expander cycle engine." Corky eyed her suspiciously. "Expander cycle engines are still in the theoretical stage, on paper. Nobody's actually testing. That's decades away." Rachel shook her head. "Sorry, Corky, NASA has prototypes. They're testing."
"What?"
Corky looked skeptical.
"ECEs run on liquid oxygen hydrogen, which freezes in space, making the engine worthless to NASA. They said they weren't even going to try to build an ECE until they overcame the freezing fuel problem."
"They overcame it. They got rid of the oxygen and turned the fuel into a slush hydrogen mixture, which is some kind of cryogenic fuel consisting of pure hydrogen in a semi-frozen state. It's very powerful and very clean burning. It's also a contender for the propulsion system if NASA runs missions to Mars."
Corky looked amazed.
"This can't be true."
"It better be true," Rachel said. "I wrote a brief about it for the president. My boss was up in arms because NASA wanted to publicly announce slush hydrogen as a big success.
and Pickering wanted the White House to force NASA to keep slush hydrogen classified.
Why?
Not important, Rachel said, having no intention of sharing more secrets than she had to. The truth was that Pickering's desire to classify slush hydrogen's success was to fight a growing national security concern few knew existed, the alarming expansion of China's space technology. The Chinese were currently developing a deadly for-hire launch platform, which they intended to rent out to high bidders, most of whom would be U.S. enemies. The implications for U.S. security were devastating. Fortunately, the NRO knew China was pursuing a doomed propulsion fuel model for their launch platform, and Pickering saw no reason to tip them off about NASA's more promising slush hydrogen propellant.
So, Tallon said, looking uneasy, you're saying NASA has a clean-burning propulsion system that runs on pure hydrogen?
Rachel nodded.
I don't have figures, but the exhaust temperatures of these engines are apparently several times hotter than anything ever before developed. They're requiring NASA to develop all kinds of new nozzle materials.
She paused.
A large rock placed behind one of these slush hydrogen engines would be scalded by a hydrogen-rich blast of exhaust fire coming out at an unprecedented temperature. You'd get quite a fusion crust.
Come on now, Corky said. Are we back to the fake meteorite scenario?
Tallon seemed suddenly intrigued.
Actually, that's quite an idea.
The setup would be more or less like leaving a boulder on the launch pad under the space shuttle during liftoff.
God save me, Corky muttered. I'm airborne with idiots.
Corky, Tallon said, hypothetically speaking, a rock placed in an exhaust field would exhibit similar burn features to one that fell through the atmosphere, wouldn't it? You'd have the same directional striations and backflow of the melting material.
Corky grunted.
I suppose.
And Rachel's clean-burning hydrogen fuel would leave no chemical residue, only hydrogen. Increased levels of hydrogen ions in the fusion pocking.
Corky rolled his eyes.
Look, if one of these ECE engines actually exists and runs on slush hydrogen, I suppose what you're talking about is possible. But it's extremely far-fetched.
Why? Tallon asked. The process seems fairly simple.
Rachel nodded.
All you need is a 190-million-year-old fossilized rock. Blast it in a slush hydrogen engine exhaust fire and bury it in the ice. Instant meteorite.
To a tourist, maybe, Corky said, but not to a NASA scientist. You still haven't explained the chondrils.
Rachel tried to recall Corky's explanation of how chondrils formed.
You said chondrils are caused by rapid heating and cooling events in space, right?
Corky sighed.
Chondrils form when a rock, chilled in space, suddenly becomes superheated to a partial melt stage. Somewhere near 1550 Celsius. Then the rock must cool again extremely rapidly, hardening the liquid pockets into chondrils.
Tallon studied his friend.
And this process can't happen on Earth?
Impossible, Corky said. This planet doesn't have the temperature variance to cause that kind of rapid shift. You're talking here about nuclear heat and the absolute zero of space. Those extremes simply don't exist on Earth.
Rachel considered it.
At least not naturally.
Corky turned.
What's that supposed to mean?
Why couldn't the heating and cooling event have occurred here on Earth artificially? Rachel asked. The rock could have been blasted by a slush hydrogen engine and then rapidly cooled in a cryogenic freezer.
Corky stared.
Manufactured chondrils?
It's an idea.
A ridiculous one,
Corky replied, flashing his meteorite sample.
Perhaps you forget? These chondrils were irrefutably dated at 190 million years.
His tone grew patronizing.
To the best of my knowledge, Miss Sexton, 190 million years ago, nobody was running slush hydrogen engines and cryogenic coolers.
chondrils or not, Tallon thought, the evidence is piling up. He had been silent now for several minutes, deeply troubled by Rachel's newest revelation about the fusion crust. Her hypothesis, though staggeringly bold, had opened all kinds of new doors and gotten Tallon thinking in new directions. If the fusion crust is explainable, what other possibilities does that present?
You're quiet, Rachel said beside him. Tallon glanced over. For an instant, in the muted lighting of the plane, he saw a softness in Rachel's eyes that reminded him of Celia.
Shaking off the memories, he gave her a tired sigh.
Oh, I was just thinking.
She smiled.
About meteorites?
What else? Running through all the evidence, trying to figure out what's left?
Something like that.
Any thoughts?
Not really. I'm troubled by how much of the data has collapsed in light of discovering that insertion shaft beneath the ice.
Hierarchical evidence is a house of cards, Rachel said. Pull out your primary assumption and everything gets shaky. The location of the meteorite find was a primary assumption.
I'll say. When I arrived at Milne, the administrator told me the meteorite had been found inside a pristine matrix of 300-year-old ice and was more dense than any rock found anywhere in the area, which I took as logical proof that the rock had to fall from space.
You and the rest of us.
The mid-range nickel content, though persuasive, is apparently not conclusive.
It's close,
Corky said nearby, apparently listening in.
But not exact.
Corky acquiesced with a reluctant nod.
And, Tallon said, this never-before-seen species of space bug, though shockingly bizarre, in reality could be nothing more than a very old, deep-water crustacean.
Rachel nodded. And now the fusion crust.
I hate to say it, Tallon said, glancing at Corky, but it's starting to feel like there's more negative evidence than positive.
Science is not about hunches, Corky said. It's about evidence. The chondrils in this rock are decidedly meteoric. I agree with you both that everything we've seen is deeply disturbing, but we cannot ignore these chondrils. The evidence in favor is conclusive, while the evidence against is circumstantial.
Rachel frowned.
So where does that leave us?
Nowhere, Corky said. The chondrils prove we are dealing with a meteorite. The only question is why someone stuck it under the ice.
Tallon wanted to believe his friend's sound logic, but something just felt wrong.
You don't look convinced, Mike,
Corky said. Tallon gave his friend a bewildered sigh.
I don't know. 2 out of 3 wasn't bad, Corky. But we're down to 1 out of 3. I just feel like we're missing something.
Chapter 90.
I got caught,
Chris Harper thought, feeling a chill as he pictured an American prison cell.
Senator Sexton knows I lied about the pod software.
As the pod's section manager escorted Gabriel Ash back into his office and closed the door, he felt his hatred of the NASA administrator grow deeper by the instant. Tonight, Harper had learned just how deep the administrator's lies truly ran. In addition to forcing Harper to lie about having fixed pod software, the administrator had apparently set up some insurance, just in case Harper got cold feet and decided not to be a team player.
Evidence of embezzlement, Harper thought. Blackmail. Very sly.
After all, who would believe an embezzler trying to discredit the single greatest moment in American space history? Harper had already witnessed to what length the NASA administrator would go to save America's space agency, and now with the announcement of a meteorite with fossils, the stakes had skyrocketed. Harper paced for several seconds around the wide table on which sat a scale model of the pod satellite. A cylindrical prism with multiple antennae and lenses behind reflective shields. Gabrielle sat down, her dark eyes watching, waiting. The nausea in Harper's gut reminded him of how he had felt during the infamous press conference. He'd put on a lousy show that night, and everyone had questioned him about it. He'd had to lie again and say he was feeling ill that night and was not himself. His colleagues and the press shrugged off his lackluster performance and quickly forgot about it. Now the lie had come back to haunt him. Gabriel Ashe's expression softened.
"Mr. Harper, with the administrator as an enemy, you will need a powerful ally. Senator Sexton could well be your only friend at this point. Let's start with a pod software lie. Tell me what happened."
Harper sighed. He knew it was time to tell the truth.
"I bloody well should have told the truth in the first place."
"The pod's launch went smoothly," he began. "The satellite settled into a perfect polar orbit, just as planned."
Gabriel Ashe looked bored. Apparently she knew all this.
"Go on."
"Then came the trouble. When we geared up to start searching the ice for density anomalies, the onboard anomaly detection software failed."
"Uh-huh."
Harper's words came faster now.
"The software was supposed to be able to rapidly examine thousands of acres of data and find parts of the ice that fell outside the range of normal ice density. Primarily, the software was looking for soft spots in the ice, global warming indicators. But if it stumbled across other density incongruities, it was programmed to flag those as well. The plan was for pods to scan the Arctic Circle over several weeks and identify any anomalies that we could use to measure global warming."
"But without functioning software," Gabriel said, "Pods was no good. NASA would have had to examine images of every square inch of the Arctic by hand, looking for trouble spots."
Harper nodded, reliving the nightmare of his programming gaffe.
"It would take decades. The situation was terrible. Because of a flaw in my programming, Pods was essentially worthless. With the election coming up and Senator Sexton being so critical of NASA..."
He sighed. "Your mistake was devastating to NASA and the president.
It couldn't have come at a worse time. The administrator was livid. I promised him I could fix the problem during the next shuttle mission. A simple matter of swapping out the chip that held the pod's software system. But it was too little, too late. He sent me home on leave, but essentially I was fired. That was a month ago.
And yet you were back on television 2 weeks ago, announcing you'd found a workaround."
Harper slumped. "A terrible mistake. That was the day I got a desperate call from the administrator. He told me something had come up, a possible way to redeem myself. I came into the office immediately and met with him. He asked me to hold a press conference and tell everyone I'd found a workaround for the pod software, and that we would have data in a few weeks. He said he'd explain it to me later."
"And you agreed?"
"No, I refused. But an hour later, the administrator was back in my office with the White House senior advisor."
"What?"
Gabrielle looked astounded by this.
"Marjorie Tench?"
"An awful creature,"
Harper thought, nodding.
"She and the administrator sat me down and told me my mistake had quite literally put NASA and the president on the brink of total collapse.
Miss Tench told me about the senator's plans to privatize NASA. She told me I owed it to the president and space agency to make it all right. And she told me how."
Gabrielle leaned forward.
"Go on."
"Marjorie Tench informed me that the White House, by sheer good fortune, had intercepted strong geologic evidence that an enormous meteorite was buried in the Milne ice shelf, one of the biggest ever. A meteorite of that size would be a major find for NASA."
Gabrielle looked stunned.
"Hold on. So you're saying someone already knew the meteorite was there before Pods discovered it?"
"Yes. Pods had nothing to do with the discovery. The administrator knew the meteorite existed. He simply gave me the coordinates and told me to reposition Pods over the ice shelf and pretend Pods made the discovery."
"You're kidding me."
"That was my reaction.
when they asked me to participate in the sham. They refused to tell me how they'd found out the meteorite was there, but Miss Tench insisted it didn't matter, and that this was the ideal opportunity to salvage my pod's fiasco. If I could pretend the pod satellite located the meteorite, then NASA could praise pods as a much-needed success and boost the president before the election.
Gabrielle was awestruck.
And of course you couldn't claim pods had detected a meteorite until you'd announced that the pod's anomaly detection software was up and running.
Harper nodded.
Hence the press conference lie. I was forced into it. Tench and the administrator were ruthless. They reminded me I'd let everyone down. The president had funded my pods project. NASA had spent years on it. And now I'd ruined the whole thing with a programming blunder.
So you agreed to help?
I didn't have a choice. My career was essentially over if I didn't. And the reality was that if I hadn't muffed the software, pods would have found that meteorite on its own. So it seemed a small lie at the time. I rationalized it by telling myself that the software would be fixed in a few months when the space shuttle went up. So I would simply be announcing the fix a little early.
Gabrielle let out a whistle. A tiny lie to take advantage of a meteoric opportunity. Harper was feeling ill just talking about it.
So, I did it. Following the administrator's orders, I held a press conference announcing that I'd found a workaround for my anomaly detection software. I waited a few days, and then I repositioned pods over the administrator's meteorite coordinates. Then, following the proper chain of command, I phoned the EOS director and reported that pods had located a hard-density anomaly in the Milne ice shelf. I gave him the coordinates and told him the anomaly appeared to be dense enough to be a meteorite. Excitedly, NASA sent a small team up to Milne to take some drill cores. That's when the operation got very hush-hush.
So you had no idea that the meteorite had fossils until tonight?
Nobody here did. We're all in shock. Now everyone is calling me a hero for finding proof of extraterrestrial bioforms. And I don't know what to say.
Gabrielle was silent a long moment, studying Harper with firm black eyes. But if pods didn't locate the meteorite in the ice, how did the administrator know the meteorite was there?
Someone else found it first.
Someone else? Who? Harper sighed.
A Canadian geologist named Charles Brophy. A researcher on Ellesmere Island. Apparently he was doing geologic ice soundings on the Milne ice shelf when he by chance discovered the presence of what appeared to be a huge meteorite in the ice. He radioed it in, and NASA happened to intercept the transmission.
Gabrielle stared. But isn't this Canadian furious that NASA is taking all the credit for the find?
No,
Harper said, feeling a chill.
Conveniently, he's dead.
Chapter 91. Michael Tollan closed his eyes and listened to the drone of the G4 jet engine. He had given up trying to think any more about the meteorite until they got back to Washington. The chondrules, according to Corky, were conclusive. The rock in the Milne ice shelf could only be a meteorite. Rachel had hoped to have a conclusive answer for William Pickering by the time they landed, but her thought experiments had run into a dead end with the chondrules. As suspicious as the meteorite evidence was, the meteorite appeared to be authentic.
So be it.
Rachel had obviously been shaken by the trauma in the ocean. Tolland was amazed, though, by her resilience. She was focused now on the issue at hand, trying to find a way to debunk or authenticate the meteorite, and trying to assess who had tried to kill them. For most of the trip, Rachel had been in the seat beside Tolland. He'd enjoyed talking to her, despite the trying circumstances. Several minutes ago, she'd headed back to the restroom, and now Tolland was surprised to find himself missing her beside him. He wondered how long it had been since he'd missed a woman's presence, a woman other than Celia.
Mr. Tolland?
Tolland glanced up. The pilot was sticking his head into the cabin.
You asked me to tell you when we were in telephone range of your ship. I can get you that connection if you want.
Thanks.
Tolland made his way up the aisle. Inside the cockpit, Tolland placed a call to his crew. He wanted to let them know that he wouldn't be back for another day or two. Of course, he had no intention of telling them what trouble he'd run into. The phone rang several times, and Tolland was surprised to hear the ship's Shincom 2100 communications system pick up. The outgoing message wasn't the usual professional-sounding greeting, but rather the rowdy voice of one of Tolland's crew, the onboard Joker.
Hiya, hiya, this is the Goya, the voice announced. We're sorry nobody's here right now, but we've all been abducted by very large lice. Actually, we've taken temporary shore leave to celebrate Mike's huge night. Gosh, are we proud? You can leave your name and number, and maybe we'll get back to you tomorrow when we're sober. Ciao! Go, E.T.!
Tolland laughed, missing his crew already. Obviously, they'd seen the press conference. He was glad they'd gone ashore. He'd abandoned them rather abruptly when the president called, and their sitting idle at sea, he was crazy. Although the message said everyone had gone ashore, Tolland had to assume they would not have left his ship unattended, particularly in the strong currents where it was now anchored. Tolland pressed the numeric code to play any internal voicemail messages they'd left for him. The line beeped once, one message. The voice was the same rowdy crew member.
Hi, Mike! One hell of a show! If you're hearing this, you're probably checking your messages from some swanky White House party and wondering where the hell we are. Sorry we abandoned ship, buddy, but this was not a dry celebration kind of night. Don't worry, we anchored her really good and left the porch light on. We're secretly hoping she gets pirated, so you'll let NBC buy you that new boat. Just kidding, man. Don't worry, Xavier agreed to stay on board and mind the fort. She said she'd prefer time alone to partying with a bunch of drunken fishmongers. Can you believe that?
Tolland chuckled, relieved to hear someone was aboard watching the ship. Xavier was responsible, definitely not the partying type. A respected marine geologist, Xavier had the reputation for speaking her mind with a caustic honesty.
Anyhow, Mike, the message went on, tonight was incredible. Kind of makes you proud to be a scientist, doesn't it? Everyone's talking about how good this looks for NASA. Screw NASA, I say. This looks even better for us. Amazing Seas ratings must have gone up a few million points tonight. You're a star, man. A real one. Congrats. Excellent job.
There was hushed talking on the line, and the voice came back.
Oh, yeah, and speaking of Xavier, just so you don't get too big a head, she wants to razz you about something. Here she is.
Xavier's razor voice came on the machine.
Mike, Xavier, you're a god, yada yada. And because I love you so much, I've agreed to babysit this antediluvian wreck of yours. Frankly, it'll be nice to be away from these hoodlums you call scientists. Anyhow, in addition to babysitting the ship, the crew has asked me, in my role as onboard bitch, to do everything in my power to keep you from turning into a conceited bastard, which after tonight I realize is going to be difficult. But I had to be the first to tell you that you made a boo-boo in your documentary.
Yes, you heard me.
A rare Michael Tolland brain fart. Don't worry, there are only about 3 people on Earth who will notice, and they're all anal-retentive marine geologists with no sense of humor. A lot like me. But you know what they say about us geologists, always looking for faults?
She laughed.
Anyhow, it's nothing, a minuscule point about meteorite petrology. I only mention it to ruin your night. You might get a call or two about it, so I thought I'd give you the heads up, so you don't end up sounding like the moron we all know you really are.
She laughed again.
Anyhow, I'm not much of a party animal, so I'm staying on board. Don't bother calling me. I had to turn on the machine because the goddamn press have been calling all night. You're a real star tonight, despite your screw-up. Anyhow, I'll fill you in on it when you get back. Ciao.
The line went dead. Michael Tolland frowned. A mistake in my documentary? Rachel Sexton stood in the restroom of the G4 and looked at herself in the mirror. She looked pale, she thought, and more frail than she'd imagined. Tonight's scare had taken a lot out of her. She wondered how long it would be before she would stop shivering, or before she would go near an ocean. Removing her USS Charlotte cap, she let her hair down. Better, she thought, feeling more like herself. Looking into her eyes, Rachel sensed a deep weariness. Beneath it, though, she saw the resolve. She knew that was her mother's gift. Nobody tells you what you can and can't do. Rachel wondered if her mother had seen what happened tonight. Someone tried to kill me, Mom. Someone tried to kill all of us. Rachel's mind, as it had for several hours now, scrolled through the list of names. Lawrence Ekstrom, Marjorie Tench, President Zach Herney. All had motives, and more chillingly, all had means. The president is not involved, Rachel told herself, clinging to her hope that the president she respected so much more than her own father was an innocent bystander in this mysterious incident. We still know nothing. Not who, not if, not why. Rachel had wanted to have answers for William Pickering, but so far, all she'd managed to do was raise more questions. When Rachel left the restroom, she was surprised to see Michael Tolland was not in his seat. Corky was dozing nearby. As Rachel looked around, Mike stepped out of the cockpit as the pilot hung up a radio phone. His eyes were wide with concern. What is it? Rachel asked. Tolland's voice was heavy as he told her about the phone message. A mistake in his presentation? Rachel thought Tolland was overreacting. It's probably nothing. She didn't tell you specifically what the error was? Something to do with meteorite petrology. Rock structure? Yeah. She said the only people who would notice the mistake were a few other geologists. It sounds like whatever error I made was related to the composition of the meteorite itself. Rachel drew a quick breath, understanding now. Chondrules? I don't know. But it seems pretty coincidental. Rachel agreed. The chondrules were the one remaining shred of evidence that categorically supported NASA's claim that this was indeed a meteorite. Corky came over, rubbing his eyes.
What's going on?
Tolland filled him in. Corky scowled, shaking his head.
It's not a problem with the chondrules, Mike. No way. All of your data came from NASA. And from me. It was flawless.
What other petrologic error could I have made?
Who the hell knows? Besides, what do marine geologists know about chondrules?
I have no idea, but she's damned sharp. Considering the circumstances, Rachel said, I think we should talk to this woman before we talk to Director Pickering. Tolland shrugged. I called her 4 times and got the machine. She's probably in the hydro lab and can't hear a damn thing anyway. She won't get my messages until morning at the earliest. Tolland paused, checking his watch. Although what? Tolland eyed her intensely. How important do you think it is that we talk to Xavier before we talk to your boss?
If she has something to say about chondrules, I'd say it's critical, Mike, Rachel said. At the moment, we've got all kinds of contradictory data.
William Pickering is a man accustomed to having clear answers. When we meet him, I'd love to have something substantial for him to act on. Then we should make a stop. Rachel did a double take.
On your ship?
It's off the coast of New Jersey, almost directly on our way to Washington. We can talk to Xavier, find out what she knows. Corky still has the meteorite sample, and if Xavier wants to run some geologic tests on it, the ship has a fairly well-equipped lab. I can't imagine it would take us more than an hour to get some conclusive answers. Rachel felt a pulse of anxiety. The thought of having to face the ocean again so soon was unnerving. Conclusive answers, she told herself, tempted by the possibility. Pickering will definitely want answers.
Chapter 92.
Delta One was glad to be back on solid ground.
The Aurora aircraft, despite running at only one-half power and taking a circuitous ocean route, had completed its journey in under 2 hours and afforded the Delta Force a healthy head start to take up position and prepare themselves for the additional kill the controller had requested. Now, on a private military runway outside D.C., the Delta Force left the Aurora behind and boarded their new transport, a waiting OH-58D Kiowa Warrior helicopter. Yet again, the controller is arranged for the best, Delta One thought. The Kiowa Warrior, originally designed as a light observation helicopter, had been expanded and improved to create the military's newest breed of attack helicopter. The Kiowa boasted infrared thermal imaging capability, enabling its designator, laser rangefinder, to provide autonomous designation for laser-guided precision weapons, like air-to-air Stinger missiles and the AGM-1148 Hellfire missile system. The high-speed digital signal processor provided simultaneous multi-target tracking of up to 6 targets. Few enemies had ever seen a Kiowa up close and survived to tell the tale. Delta One felt a familiar rush of power as he climbed into the Kiowa pilot's seat and strapped himself in. He had trained on this craft and flown it in covert ops 3 times. Of course, never before had he been gunning for a prominent American official. The Kiowa, he had to admit, was the perfect aircraft for the job. Its Rolls-Royce Allison engine and twin semi-rigid blades were silent running, which essentially meant targets on the ground could not hear the chopper until it was directly over them. And because the aircraft was capable of flying blind without lights and was painted flat black with no reflective tail numbers, it was essentially invisible unless the target had radar. Silent black helicopters. The conspiracy theorists were going nuts over these. Some claimed the invasion of silent black helicopters was proof of New World Order stormtroopers under the authority of the United Nations. Others claimed the choppers were silent alien probes. Still others who saw the Kiowas in tight formation at night were deceived into thinking they were looking at fixed running lights on a much larger craft, a single flying saucer that was apparently capable of vertical flight. Wrong again. But the military loved the diversion. During a recent covert mission, Delta One had flown a Kiowa armed with the most secretive new U.S. military technology. An ingenious holographic weapon nicknamed S&M. Despite conjuring associations with sadomasochism, S&M stood for smoke and mirrors. Holographic images projected into the sky over enemy territory. The Kiowa had used S&M technology to project holograms of U.S. aircraft over an enemy anti-aircraft installation. The panicked anti-aircraft gunners fired maniacally at the circling ghosts. When all of their ammunition was gone, the United States sent in the real thing. As Delta One and his men lifted off the runway, Delta One could still hear the words of his controller. "You have another mark." It seemed an egregious understatement, considering the new target's identity. Delta One reminded himself, however, that it was not his place to question. His team had been given an order, and they would carry it out in the exact method instructed, as shocking as that method was. "I hope to hell the controller is certain this is the right move." As the Kiowa lifted off the runway, Delta One headed southwest. He had seen the FDR Memorial twice, but tonight would be his first time from the air. Chapter 93. "This meteorite was originally discovered by a Canadian geologist?" Gabrielle Ash stared in astonishment at the young programmer, Chris Harper. "And this Canadian is now dead?" Harper gave a grim nod. "How long have you known this?" she demanded. "A couple of weeks. After the administrator and Marjorie Tench forced me to perjure myself in the press conference, they knew I couldn't go back on my word.
They told me the truth about how the meteorite was really discovered. Pods is not responsible for finding the meteorite. Gabriel had no idea where all of this information would lead, but clearly it was scandalous. Bad news for Tench, great news for the senator.
As I mentioned, Harper said, looking somber now, the true way the meteorite was discovered was through an intercepted radio transmission. Are you familiar with a program called INSPIRE? The interactive NASA Space Physics Ionosphere Radio Experiment?
Gabriel had heard of it only vaguely.
Essentially, Harper said, is a series of very low-frequency radio receivers near the North Pole that listens to the sounds of the Earth. Plasma wave emissions from the northern lights, broadband pulses from lightning storms, that sort of thing.
Okay.
A few weeks ago, one of INSPIRE's radio receivers picked up a stray transmission from Ellesmere Island. A Canadian geologist was calling for help at an exceptionally low frequency.
Harper paused.
In fact, the frequency was so low that nobody other than NASA's VLF receivers could possibly have heard it. We assumed the Canadian was long-waving.
I'm sorry?
Broadcasting at the lowest possible frequency to get maximum distance on his transmission. He was in the middle of nowhere, remember. A standard frequency transmission probably would not have made it far enough to be heard.
What did his message say?
The transmission was short. The Canadian said he had been out doing ice soundings on the Milne ice shelf. Had detected an ultra-dense anomaly buried in the ice. Suspected it was a giant meteorite, and while taking measurements, had become trapped in a storm. He gave his coordinates, asked for rescue from the storm, and signed off. The NASA listening post sent a plane from Thule to rescue him. They searched for hours, and finally discovered him, miles off course, dead, at the bottom of a crevasse with his sled and dogs. Apparently, he tried to outrun the storm, got blinded, went off course, and fell into a crevasse.
Gabriel considered the information, intrigued.
So, suddenly NASA knew about a meteorite that nobody else knew about.
Exactly.
And ironically, if my software had been working properly, the pod satellite would have spotted that same meteorite a week before the Canadian did.
The coincidence gave Gabriel pause.
A meteorite buried for 300 years was almost discovered twice in the same week? I know, a little bizarre. But science can be like that. Feast or famine. The point is that the administrator felt like the meteorite should have been our discovery anyway, if I had done my job correctly. He told me that because the Canadian was dead, nobody would be the wiser. If I simply redirected pods to the coordinates the Canadian had transmitted in his SOS, then I could pretend to discover the meteorite from scratch, and we could salvage some respect from an embarrassing failure.
And that's what you did.
As I said, I had no choice. I had let down the mission.
He paused. Tonight, though, when I heard the president's press conference and found out the meteorite I'd pretended to discover contained fossils, you were stunned.
Bloody well floored, I'd say.
Do you think the administrator knew the meteorite contained fossils before he asked you to pretend pods found it?
I can't imagine how. That meteorite was buried and untouched until the first NASA team got there. My best guess is that NASA had no idea what they'd really found until they got a team up there to drill cores and X-ray. They asked me to lie about pods, thinking they'd have a moderate victory with a big meteorite. Then when they got there, they realized just how big a find it really was.
Gabriel's breath was shallow with excitement.
Dr. Harper, will you testify that NASA and the White House forced you to lie about the pod software?
I don't know.
Harper looked frightened. I can't imagine what kind of damage that would do to the agency, to this discovery.
Dr. Harper, you and I both know this meteorite remains a wonderful discovery, regardless of how it came about. The point here is that you lied to the American people. They have a right to know that pods is not everything NASA says it is.